It's On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Virginia Prescott. Flannery O'Connor is regarded by many as Georgia's greatest fiction writer. Her dark humor, eccentric characters, and determined Catholic faith made her a leading voice in Southern Gothic literature. O'Connor was born in Savannah, but lived off and on at Andalusia, her family farm in Milledgeville, until her death at 39. Andalusia is now a museum. It's been under renovation since last year and reopens next week. Matt Davis is Georgia College's Director of Historic Museums, which includes Andalusia. Hello, Matt.
Good morning. How are you today?
Very well. Excited to talk about this. And Mary Lawrence Kinnickel is with us. She's an artist from Savannah and a close friend of the O'Connor family. Thanks for speaking with us, Mary Lawrence.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So, Matt, when did Flannery O'Connor live at Andalusia?
Following her diagnosis of lupus, Miss O'Connor lived at Andalusia from 1951 to her death on August 3rd, 1964. And during her time at the farm, this is where she wrote the bulk of her important stories and novels during her time on the property.
Andalusia is a very exotic name. Where did that come from?
It was inspired, actually, by the original name of the property in a very O'Connor-esque fashion. While riding on a bus in Atlanta, she happened to meet a previous owner of the property, as her family had originally called Andalusia Sorrel Farms, named from the horses that her uncle Bernard rode on the property, and found that the historic name was Andalusia, which he thought had a nice ring to it, so restored it to the grounds.
And Mary Lawrence, did you ever visit Andalusia?
I did in my childhood, and then also in 1979 and 80, I managed the property for Regina.
Huh. So how did you know Flannery O'Connor's family?
Both families were members of Sacred Heart Catholic Church. My father was a dentist and served that family and also the Hills and shot and other workers on the property, and so we were all connected in a variety of ways. My mother was an educator, of course. Flannery had gone to Peabody and then on to what is today Georgia College and State University, and my mother taught there and later became the alumni director.
So, Matt. Wanted to pick up with this idea of her family. I mean, you looked at this home. You must have spent a lot of time thinking about it. What kind of read did you get on Flannery O'Connor's family from that home?
It's a wonderful story, and I think it's one of not only faith but love and support. During the years in which Flannery was there following her diagnosis and illness, the world revolved around Flannery, particularly through the work and the support of her mother, Regine Cline O'Connor, who did everything to protect her daughter's health, encourage her writing, but also was a manager of a family farm. And these are issues that we're going to explore in great detail for visitors coming to the site.
So, Mary, did you see this place, Andalusia, come through in her stories?
I did. I also saw characters, as many Milledgevillians did, that were part of our everyday life and experience, whether it was someone being gored to death by a bull, which happened months before in a neighboring farm from the Nelligan farm. She was a fantastic storyteller, and so she could weave all of these happenings into her stories, her short stories, and also the two novels.
Well, one of the things that she's known for is these somewhat freakish characters that she creates, and she addressed that. This is in a 1960 essay called Some Aspects of the Grotesque in Southern Fiction. Here's Flannery O'Connor.
Whenever I'm asked why Southern writers particularly have a penchant for writing about freaks, I say it's because we are still able to recognize one. To be able to recognize a freak, you have to have some conception of the whole man. And in the South, the general conception of man is still theological.
So, Mary Lawrence, you said that some of the Milledgevillians might recognize themselves in her fiction. How did they respond to that?
Not well. You might throw a book across the room when they read it for the first time, or certainly express their concerns to Regina that, you know, she could have spent her time a little better. But We all delight in it. The names were always changed. That's all that really matters.
I guess that's what you need to do in a small town. However, she did. Here she is reading from the same essay, denying that everybody in Milledgeville was like this.
I'm always having it pointed out to me that life in Georgia is not at all the way I depict it. Those escaped criminals do not roam the roads exterminating families, nor Bible salesmen prowl about looking for girls with wooden legs. It's very hard to get it across that where you belong is with the writers of romance.
So not everybody is a Bible salesman prowling about looking for girls with wooden legs. Of course, a reference to her probably most famous story, A Good Man is Hard to Find. Matt, Flannery O'Connor has such a passionate following. People make pilgrimages to places like Milledgeville to understand her life. So what are they going to find there at Andalusia?
I think the visitor today, following the renovation work that's been done there, are going to be able to experience a landscape more true to the time that O'Connor was on the property. They will also get to explore rooms in a way that has not previously been allowed, such as entering O'Connor's bedroom and seeing some pieces such as the bookcases that were part of her prized possession and her original desk back into the property. And by adding objects like this to kind of give that true sense of space, it better connects people not only to the inspirations but the influences, but you can get a sense of what life truly was like at the property, which historic sites like this can't be replicated. That's the reason we come to them, to experience, to breathe the air, stand in the spots, and really understand the person.
Yeah, I understand it was a pretty humble home for the most part. So how do you approach a renovation for something like that, keeping it intact?
As responsible stewards of historic sites, our main goal is to follow the Secretary of the Interior standards for historic preservation. So we approach this in a way to preserve and maintain as much of the original fabric or building materials as possible. And our approach in this has been stabilization and repair. Repair and stabilized plaster walls. Through ample documentary and primary evidence, we were able to replicate historic colors. And a great deal of the original furnishings were there. We just have been able to add to that as well. So through some very sound historical research and a little detective work, I think we have brought back a product that a Flannery herself would know well.
So Mary Lawrence, you were there, your family, you were also a farming family, I believe. It was a working farm when you knew it, correct?
It was, and probably the one thing that visitors will enjoy is a pristine environment, which, because it was a working farm, it was never pristine. And there was always something to be done. There were cobwebs, and it was always tidy. But I have seen in the last 5 years that character and personality lost, and I look forward to seeing it come back.
How is it lost? What do you mean by that?
It was just cleaned up in a different sort of way. And possibly the footprint of a building may have been there, but it may have also been a bit changed if it became the stage for some kind of activity. It felt different. And furnishings and things had been moved around, and I'm delighted that Matt is bringing things back to try to create that sense of space in Flannery's bedroom, and, you know, hopefully bringing the piano back to the foyer and present the dining room as a dining room, as we always enjoyed it. I have no idea. I haven't been there.
Well, it's funny.
It does sound that he's Georgia College is being quite sensitive to the preservation of the actual, and I appreciate that.
It's funny because you imagine, you know, somebody living in their home. She's living with her mom. She has lupus. You know, this is declining years for her in many ways. For someone to walk into anyone's home and see it as it was, what do you think the O'Connor family would think of all these visitors tromping through their house?
Is that to me? I'm sorry.
Sure, pick it up.
I honestly think there would be a little bit of sense of amusement on Flannery's part about this, in a way. But I think from a greater family standpoint, I think that there is a sense of appreciation, and to echo what you're saying, that we're, in our current approach, being very sensitive to try to recreate that environment as close as possible to present a true picture of what the site looked like, and to arrange things in a way that a visitor to the farm at the time and a family and Flannery herself would recognize and enjoy. And for us, and as public historians and, if you will, custodians of these historic sites, that's our duty and our responsibility to give that true picture and reflection.
Well, of course, one of the things about Flannery O'Connor is that deep sense of place and southernness. Here she is. This is from the same essay that we're talking about from 1957, talking about how a southerner's sense of place affects her writing.
The Southern writer can't escape the image of the South that has built up a life of its own in his senses, any more than the Catholic can escape the indelible marks that the sacraments put on his soul. The Southerner's sense of place is usually as unadjustable as the believing Catholic sense of right and wrong.
The Catholic sense of right and wrong, such a deep part of the writing of Flannery O'Connor. Now, Mary Lawrence, your family were also Catholics, very close to the O'Connor family. What did that faith mean to her writing? How did she bring it forward?
I think in presenting the opportunity for redemption, even, you know, as she wove such violence and her dark humor through and the irony through her work. But there's always that opportunity for sanctification. There's always the opportunity for change. And usually the individuals are too close to the matter to recognize that. But I think, too, it was a time people need to remember when it was the Bible Belt.
Right.
And although you may not have had people walking around with a Bible in their hand trying to sell on that, it was a difficult time to be Catholic. There were times when in my school setting, I was with the authority figures, the teachers, the student aides from Georgia College. I wasn't allowed to play whatever game it was where people were touching because I was Catholic. You know, there was a lot of ignorance. They didn't believe we were Christian, that we rather idolized statues and our God was a woman. And so they essentially, as even I was brought up, and I'm sure that Flannery went through the same, to model behavior, educating people, but the most you could do was pray for them when they thought you had cooties or something. You know, we during the 60s, there was even a country club established, and certainly they came wanting my father to assist in the financing, but we were Catholic. So there was tremendous conversation. You know, there were certain people not being included, Catholics and the African-American individuals. And all of that has changed. Milledgeville has come so far, but it also was a time when even the Central State Hospital, if
Mary Lawrence Kinnickel, sorry, we're up against a break.
I really
appreciate you being here. Mary Lawrence Kinnickel, an artist living in Savannah, a friend of the O'Connor family, of course, of Flannery O'Connor. Thank you. And Matt Davis, Georgia College Director of Museums, and Flannery O'Connor's home in Milledgeville. Milledgeville is one of those museums. It's going to open to the public next week, June 19th. More at gpbnews.org. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 2018 FIFA Men's World Cup begins today in Moscow with Russia taking on Saudi Arabia. The global spectacle happens every 4 years. The American team was knocked out in qualifying rounds, but the U.S. and Georgia will still be represented by a delegation of students from Kennesaw State University. Student journalists are going to be there reporting, podcasting, and live tweeting as some of the world's best athletes go toe-to-toe. We're going to talk with them and their professor from Moscow in just a couple of minutes. But first, my colleague Taylor Gant is here to tell us what to expect for the Games. Good morning, Taylor.
Good morning, Virginia.
So you are one of GPB Radio's resident super sporty guys.
That is safe to say, yes.
You excited for the World Cup?
Well, it's a very bittersweet feeling right now because, as you mentioned, the U.S. national team will not be participating in this year's World Cup. But on the other side, there is so much action happening that despite everything, you're still going to get to see the best players in the world making everything happen. So I do believe that despite the U.S. not having a presence, it's still going to be a great game.
Okay, the U.S. Lost in qualifying rounds to
Trinidad and Tobago.
Okay.
In October.
This is how one sportscaster summed up that loss.
Every single one of those players,
they can take some
nightmares
yep.
for the rest of their lives because this is an utter embarrassment with the amount of money that is in Major League Soccer and in this sport. You can't get a draw, a tie against Trinidad? Max, you don't deserve to go to the World Cup.
Utter embarrassment, nightmare for the rest of their lives. It's pretty harsh words.
Well, I think that was the general reaction from the entire sports society here in America after that loss in Trinidad, because America has put so much time and effort into trying to become, a world power to gain respect in a game that they haven't really been playing for all that long. So to lose in a qualifying game like that in a region that's, not very strong, we were by far the favorite to get through in the CONCACAF region, which makes up North America and Central America. And that loss really is kind of unprecedented for a team that really had a lot of high hopes, making the World Cup every 4 years since 1990.
Okay, well, I think it's safe to say everyone's licked some of their wounds since October. We can move on. But first, some basics on the World Cup. How long did the games go on?
So it's roughly a little over a month. It begins today, in just about 2 hours, actually. Russia will start off against Saudi Arabia. And it's 32 teams broken off into 8 different groups of 4 each. They play a round-robin style, so each team in a group will play all the other teams in that group. And then from there, the top 2 teams will move on to the round of 16. Super simple. Winner stays, loser goes home. And eventually on, I believe it's July 15th, the final will be played in Moscow to determine the 2018 World Cup champion.
How do you think that the fact that the U.S. team is not going to be there is going to affect viewership here in America?
Well, I think in America proper, I think it's going to have a pretty big effect. I mean, I think that, the World Cup draws in people who may have never watched a soccer game. So the spectacle of the event is in itself something that will draw a lot of people. In Atlanta, I think the effect will be a little bit lesser because we have a very diverse group of people here in the metro area and across the state, especially people who have rooting interests elsewhere, maybe from South America, Central America. And those teams will be well represented in the World Cup. But since there will be no representation there from a U.S. team, that's kind of an opportunity gone missing.
Well, it's not easy to watch the games anyway. Moscow's 7 hours ahead of us here on the East Coast. So what do people do? They get up at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Well, only some of the games will require such dedication to the game of soccer. Like, for instance, this morning's game will start at 11 here on the East Coast. Some of the games will start earlier, later next week. One's going to start at 6 Eastern, so that'll be 3 o'clock Pacific. So unless you have a determination to watch every minute live, you can always catch it on demand or just catch up on Twitter if it's not a game that's of incredible significance. Later on, the games will be, I think, more in a slot where people around the world will be able to watch it.
Let's go back to the last World Cup. This was in 2014 in Brazil. Final matchup, Germany against Argentina. But the biggest story here around the world was the semifinal between Brazil and Germany. Let's listen to just a clip from that game.
This is quite astonishing. It's all over now. It really is all over for Brazil. Brazil 1, Germany 7.
The home team lost. What happened?
Well, first, I'd like to apologize to all of our Brazilian listeners for bringing that back into your consciousness.
It's
been 4 long years. It was really, I remember watching that game live, and it was an incredibly shocking result. Brazil was hosting the World Cup that year. The build-up to that game, it was the semifinal. The winner goes to the final. And there was incredible optimism that Brazil was finally going to break this streak. They hadn't won the World Cup since 2002. It had been many years. And they thought that this was the team that was going to be able to do it. And then, you know, to get embarrassed like that, 7-1, seven straight goals by Germany. There were men, women, and children all crying in the stands that day. And the it really was kind of a sight to behold. But hopefully as far as the Brazilian side is concerned, they'll erase some of that memory in the next few weeks.
Well, this is Russia's first time hosting a big coup on the world stage. What are we watching for? Country's favorite to win? Any players to know?
Okay, so the top three players right now, and this is arguable, of course, you have Neymar from Brazil, you have Cristiano Ronaldo from Portugal, and you have Lionel Messi of Argentina. And each of those sides will be heavy favorites to go far in the competition and to have a chance to win. Germany, of course, is the defending champ. They have one of the best goalies in the world, Manuel Neuer, who is still in top form. So really, you know, we can compare sometimes tournaments like March Madness, where we have Cinderellas that will potentially, you know, smaller countries that might rise through the ranks and beat one of the established powers. But most of the time, the big dogs are the ones that move through this competition just because of the difference in talent when it comes to some of those established soccer powers.
So, Taylor, it's just been announced that the U.S. and Canada and Mexico are going to jointly host the World Cup in 2026. Atlanta now in the running to host one of the major matches in the North American turf. Is one more step into making Atlanta a major sports city or a major soccer city?
Well, as a constant defender of sports in Atlanta, because we get a bad rap over the years for being kind of a fair weather city and a place where sports really, you know, doesn't take precedent a lot of times. I think we've already made several huge steps. I mean, just think of this last year. We hosted the NCAA football championship. Next year comes the Super Bowl, which is going to be another massive event. And then 8 years from now, hopefully, we'll be hosting World Cup soccer. And compare that to the incredible fervor surrounding Atlanta United, which has really swept the city, 70,000 people breaking new records almost on a weekly basis. So I think it's safe to say that this edition of a World Cup game will be reaffirming. But I'd like to think that we've already made the jump from, you know, a bad sports town to a really quality sports location.
Sounds that way. That is Taylor Gant. He's my phone-a-friend guy today, explaining the World Cup and giving us a little bit of a primer. We're talking about the 2018 FIFA World Cup, which kicks off today in Moscow. And Kennesaw State University journalism professor Carolyn Carlson is there with four students who are going to be reporting on the World Cup. Carolyn is joining us with two students by Skype. Hello, Carolyn.
Hello.
Also with us, two of our students, Alex Keller and Virginia Wyckoff. Hello there, or should I say, Zdravstvuyte.
Privet.
Well, I have no idea what you said back because I only watched one YouTube video about greetings in Russian. But Carolyn, they're sending students over to cover an international sporting event. This is a first for KSU.
It certainly is. We've only been offering sports reporting for about 3 years now. It's a high demand course. A lot of students want to become sports reporters, and we try and give them enough information and experience that they can become sports reporters when they graduate. This is a wonderful opportunity for these students to get some experience that they have no other way of getting, to be able to cover an international sporting event and write stories on deadline and in a way that real sports reporters do. So this is going to be a really good experience for them, and it'll help them become sports reporters if that's what they choose to do when they graduate.
Well, it seems like a pretty plum assignment. Alex and Virginia, were you big soccer fans before this?
I followed soccer a little bit here and there, not so much like English Premier League or anything like that, but I have been watching the MLS, especially since Atlanta United came into existence or since we were announced that we were getting a team. But I was also in attendance when the United States national team came for the Gold Cup in 2015 when they had the heartbreaking loss to Jamaica. So I think that's really when I started to really get into soccer, because then they also had that Mexico-Panama game as well at the Georgia Dome. So that whole atmosphere and everything just brought me into soccer, and that's why I'm here.
How about you, Virginia?
I personally did not know much about soccer coming in. I had to watch a lot of YouTube videos and ask some friends to explain the different types of rules. But it's definitely something that I've enjoyed so far, and I've enjoyed being here. I would definitely consider it in the future as a career.
Well, this is pretty much a crash course that you're getting there. Did you guys come over with ideas on what and how you wanted to cover the World Cup?
I'd say when I came over, I was really just looking forward to the experience of being at a World Cup and an international soccer event, because when we were signing up for the trip, I had no idea that the U.S. was going to be part of that bid for 2026. So I thought to myself, well, I don't know if I'll ever make it back to a World Cup, so why not take a class that is what I'm studying in school and what I want to do later in life, and have it on the world stage over in Moscow. So it was kind of like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and having the opportunity to cover, you know, Portugal, Argentina, and some of the like world-renowned teams in soccer is truly an honor, and it's something I'm very excited about.
We're going to cover almost all the teams that John mentioned earlier. We're going to have we're going to cover Germany. We're going to cover Brazil. We're going to cover Argentina. We're going to cover games by all the top teams. So we're really looking forward to the games themselves.
Virginia, I'd love to get a sense of what it feels like to you over there. Must be a lot of energy. Are there fans already all over the place buzzing around?
Oh, yeah. We went out to the Kremlin on our first full day, and we saw a lot of Brazil fans, a lot of
Peru fans,
just screaming out in the streets, blowing horns, showing pride and raising flags. It was fun to watch.
So you're going to be reporting alongside people who've spent their careers covering professional soccer. How did they get you ready for this, Virginia and Alex?
You know, we've done reporting in the past for other classes and had to do interviews with people. But as far as preparation, I mean, we've taken news reporting classes, and so we have a general sense of like how to cover a game and stuff like that, but nothing of the magnitude of a World Cup game and something that everyone around the world is going to be watching. So it's definitely a bigger stage and a lot more pressure on us, but I'm definitely looking forward to it because, again, like I said, this is something I really am passionate about and want to do the rest of my life. So
what makes a great sportscaster or soccer or announcer, Taylor, to you? If you were watching a game, what do you think works?
Certainly, it helps to be English. They have by far some of the best sports announcers that I've ever heard cover the sport. Maybe because of their tradition with it, they can speak from a wealth of history with the game. You know, a lot of times in soccer, there's a lot of moments where you can't just do the play-by-play. You have to talk about maybe what's going on, especially in a World Cup or an Olympic event. You want to talk about the context of what's going on in the world around the game and between the two teams behind the scenes. Anything that can fit into the broadcast makes it much better to view and to enjoy.
Is that part of your study there, learning a little bit about the context, the social history, what's going on in the country and the countries of origins who are playing the games?
Before we left, I had assigned each student countries, teams to do research on. And so they have been researching the teams, how they got to the cup and who they had to defeat to get there, who the major players are on the team. I'm not expecting them to be at a professional level as far as their knowledge of the teams and the players and the history, but I am expecting them to know who the stars are and that sort of thing, and also how they got to the cup.
Now, you will be covering matchups between Mexico and Germany and Brazil, Costa Rica. No Latin American team has ever won a World Cup held in Europe. So based on your research, let's ask you, Alex or Virginia, what do you think you're going to see?
Well, from my perspective and just looking at the two teams, of the teams that we're covering and the two that I think will probably have the best chance, Argentina would probably be your biggest chance coming from Latin America, coming off, again, the runner-up in the previous World Cup and still having Lionel Messi as their star player. I expect them to come in with a little bit of vengeance and a little more energy to get back at what happened to them in the last cup. And on the other side, I mean, away from Latin America, I think ultimately my pick to win the cup would be Portugal. And you know, a lot of people are going to say that's a bold pick, but coming off their championship win, their first big championship win at the UEFA 2016 tournament, I look to see Ronaldo help keep that momentum going. But it'll be close. I'd like to see Argentina make it far and potentially win it, especially for Messi. He's one of my favorite players of all time and one of the greatest of all time. So to see him get a cup before he calls it quits would definitely be monumental seminal moment in soccer.
Okay, Taylor Gant is nodding emphatically here in the studio.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think either one of those players is of the ones I mentioned before, Neymar, Ronaldo, or Messi, any of them getting this massive achievement in their career really solidify them as one of the greatest of all time, if they're not already.
Well, that's so exciting. Covering the World Cup. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes.
And Carolyn, I believe that you're retiring at the end of the summer. So thank you for your swan song with this trip to the World Cup with these students this year. That's really terrific.
It's a great thing to do. I'm enjoying it a lot.
Carolyn Carlson, she's Kennesaw State University journalism professor. She and her students Alex Keller and Virginia Wyckoff are in Moscow reporting on the 2018 FIFA Men's World Cup. And we will put a link to more coverage from that cup and those students at gpbnews.org. Taylor Gant, my resident sports expert here in the GPB newsroom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, Soul Cooking with chef and author Todd Richards. This is On Second Thought.
I was raised in the country, that's a natural fact. Food on the table from the garden out back. Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking where the silver queen grows. Running with your cousins from yard to yard. The living was easy, but the playing was hard. Didn't have much, nothing comes for free. All you needed was your family. I am a country girl. I've been around the world, and every place I've been ain't quite nothing like living in the South. Oh, wanna shut your mouth. I am a country girl. I am a country girl.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Father's Day tends to play second fiddle to Mother's Day, but we are dedicating tomorrow's show to Georgia dads. Well, first, we want to hear from you. How do you rate Father's Day on a scale of 1 to 10? And what's your favorite part of being a dad? You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for the conversation. For most of American history, food was segregated. The difference between where white and black Americans ate, shopped, and how they valued food was a bright line when Chef Todd Richards was growing up on Chicago's South Side. In Atlanta, he's made his mark as a James Beard Award-winning chef and owner of Richards Southern Fried. His new book, Soul, A Chef's Culinary Evolution and 150 Recipes, incorporates his personal story with reliable Southern recipes, some refreshingly creative ways to use basic ingredients, and a playlist. We're listening to some of that now. Chef Richard stepped out of the kitchen to join me this morning in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you grew up in Chicago, as I said, but like many African Americans, spent summers in the South with the family. So what kind of messages were you getting about or maybe even through food when you were growing up?
It is such a wonderful experience growing up eating delicious food, where every birthday holiday was always at our house and we were always cooking together. And the way my parents always brought other cultures into the kitchen and really relied on seasonings as a way to communicate a diverse palate was very, very important.
So you could tell that, even that at an early age, that was what you
found. I can tell that it was something just a little bit different about this dish, where you look at like a basic dish of red beans that my dad would turn into chili, but it was a little bit more cumin in it than before, and that progression of how delicious cumin could be.
So when did you become aware that this delicious food, you know, like it's like a fish swimming in water, this was just the food that was there, that it was different than the food that other people were eating?
I believe that it was really became the similarities of broth. When I look at ramen broth and collard green pot liquor, the similar tracks, or even French onion soup, you can incorporate into that, that broth, that nourishment that happens when you get that warm feeling inside of you. Chicken noodle soup is in that same America genre of deliciousness. That broth just invigorated the soul, and I knew that they were all similar, but the texture of the dishes could be different.
And you, of course, have incorporated collard greens, a traditional Southern element ingredient in food into ramen since then. When did that begin to kind of explode for you, making something that was traditional into something completely new?
I would say at an early age, my parents, my dad wouldn't throw any food away. So he required us, if we ate out, that something from leftover had to go on the table. My mom loved ramen or warming soups. And so we would have that on the table, and Dad will pull out the collard greens and heat them up. And that clashing of cultures of the vinegar and spicy collard greens on top of, you know, noodles with pork belly and soft-boiled egg and scallions was something that generationally might have been, you know, a little bit different. But for us, it was all the same.
Yeah, so it was all, it was like innovation, what, out of necessity?
I would say not only out of necessity, but also out of paying homage to our ancestors and saying that we work very hard to put this food on the table. We cannot just throw it away.
Well, this is your sermon on food, of course, and every good sermon is punctuated by a choir, and you have right. a playlist in this book. So right. let's hear just a little bit. This is a Ray Charles rendition of Lift Every Voice and Sing.
In my bones, make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to sing on.
So food and music for you, where does that all tie together?
When we would cook at the house as a kid, music was on three levels. It was outside in the backyard. It was a different set of music in the basement and probably a different set of music in the kitchen or in the dining room. So you have all these experiences being intertwined. My mom on Sunday morning before church would always get up and start the day with Nina Simone or Bob Dylan or someone like that as well.
Well, so all of this kind of twirled together for you. Is there specific music that you hear when you're making specific meals?
That's a great question. I just allow the food to tell me what music to play. And if you look at bacon and the way bacon cooks, when it gets silent in the pan, it tells you it's ready. So cooking has its own soundtrack, you know, to its own. And food and music going together creates this wonderful experience. You never want to go into a restaurant with no music. You know, the silence is so deafening. But when you can pat your feet and have a conversation with the person in front of you, and the food is delicious, that's an entire hospitality experience that most people always want to have.
And maybe hospital experiences. You were talking about the healing nature.
Oh, man, the healing nature of broths are unbelievable.
Well, I was fascinated to learn that soul food is actually a northern concept. This is a northern name, or it's kind of was code, I think, for things that were black, you know, soul music, soul food. Do you think African-American chefs get typecast for cooking soul food?
Most certainly. There's a typecast, but there's typecast throughout the entire, you know, history of soul in general, that music is one set of genre in its soul. Food-wise, though, chefs do get typecast, but the techniques are such the same between French and African and, you know, being African-American chef in the United States, that the techniques run the same gamut. Mm. And now you see more chefs embracing our culture of soul food than ever before.
Well, it's interesting because so many foods have been used to convey, you know, racist imagery. You know, the sort of, like, I've seen the old postcards of
the watermelon.
The watermelon postcards. Mm-hmm. So how do you, you have a whole chapter here on melons.
Well, I believe that it is a... one thing is that watermelons are delicious, and they are versatile. I mean, you can use the rind for pickling. They convey flavor. You can puree it and make lemonade out of it. And in understanding that stereotypes are someone else's oppressive feelings on top of you does not mean that we should not eat delicious food. You know, just in understanding that concept that someone makes you feel bad for eating something delicious does not seem very American at all.
Well, you're completely unconstrained by heritage, it seems here. Like, you start with the basics, you know, collard greens and ham hocks in the beginning of the chapter, but then you go to ginger and collard green fried rice and, you know, spicy zucchini slaw. You move in all of these kind of directions. Is this your, if this is your evolution, your culinary evolution, where are you trying to go?
Well, one thing I had to understand that economics of food means that the cuisines have to be on the same level playing field. You look at, you know, collard greens in the sense that the fat on top of it protects all that delicious pot liquor down below. And you look at duck confit from French cuisine, where the fat is protecting all the duck meat down below. So these techniques are absolutely the same, but we charge, you know, exorbitantly different amounts of money for them. So the evolution is really saying that this food has progressed and will continue to progress. That 1950s and 1960s terminology of soul food is only limited to one time period, and that the food will always continue to flourish and move forward. And it deserves a rich price because it does have a rich history.
So a lot more value for the food of traditional African-American cuisine. Todd Richards, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Todd Richards' new book is out now, and it's called Soul, A Chef's Culinary Evolution in 150 Recipes. We got a recommendation when we did our Bitter Southerner review of Southern books, ecstatic review, and it is a beautiful book. You can find more at gpbnews.org. Multiple Grammy winner Robert Glasper takes the stage at Atlanta's Variety Playhouse tomorrow night. The jazz pianist performs with his band R plus R equals Now. And that group's debut album, Collogically Speaking, features guest voices, including Omari Hardwick, Terry Crews, and hip-hop artist Mos Def. Glasper spoke with On Second Thoughts' LaRaven Taylor about the band and its new single, Change of Tone.
Just keep time, baby. I'm Robert Glasper. I am a jazz pianist and music producer. I am originally from Houston, Texas, and I am happy to be here. You know, growing up in a Baptist, Southern Baptist church is different than anything else in the whole world. You know what I mean? You're not going to find, you know, the church fan with the Martin Luther King thing on the back. And you're not going to find that everywhere. Growing up in church, playing music with that young, playing in front of people, that kind of, you know, really sets you up for doing shows and understanding what a show is and understanding how to move people through music. You know what I mean? And watching people catch this whole the Holy Spirit while you play. And it's all built off of feeling and being engaged with people. That's what church is, you know? So I think church had a lot to do with just how I react to people. And this new band, it's like a super band. I have the amazing Christian Scott. Atunji Aju on trumpet. I have Justin Tyson on drums. Blue Note recording artist Derek Hodge on the bass. Philip McFerrin and Terrace Martin as well in the band. The name of the group R plus R equals Now was pretty much inspired by Nina Simone. I remember in an interview she said, you know, how can you be an artist and not reflect the times? You know, it's our job to reflect the times. So I just took that reflect and I was like, yeah, if you reflect and you respond, then you have no choice but to be now. You have no choice but to be present. No time to waste time. Life's short. Don't trip on the past. It's gone. Let wings of the rain. Let's fly high in the sky. You and I, all alone. Different tone. Different tone. So Change of Tone, that's actually a song Derek Hodge wrote for the band. and he wrote it with all of our sensibilities, thinking about it, you know, so kind of has our personalities in the song, you know, so it's it goes from one idea, one feeling, to another idea, to another feeling, you know, and then you see when it gets interrupted by the drums, the drums do a little fill, and then it goes back to the top, and then it keeps going drum to a fill, you know what I mean? So it just keeps kind of changing direction, you know. So it's, you know, change of tone, meaning, you know, change of vibe, change of direction, you know, which can speak to a bigger picture of who we are as people and who we are as musicians and, you know, where we go as musicians, we go from this vibe to that vibe to that vibe to that vibe and, you know, try to do it as naturally as possible and honest as possible. No time to waste time, life's short. Terrace Martin's doing the vocoder now. You know, Terrace Martin did a lot of stuff for Kendrick Lamar, Pimp a Butterfly album, produced a lot of Pimp a Butterfly, produced a lot on Good Kid, Mad City, you know, a lot of stuff for Snoop Dogg and a lot of different people, you know, you can name it. He's probably done a lot, you know, so it's great to have him on the album, and he's amongst having his own albums as well, you know what I mean? So, but he does the vocoder work on the album. Any vocoder you hear, that's him. Our whole objective here is to just be honest with the gumbo of music that we all have. We all have a lot of different, come from different backgrounds, and a lot of it's some of the same backgrounds, but have different experiences, and we try to bring all that together, you know, in one band, in one setting, and just try to be honest with it, you know.